Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. My responses cover subjects of general interest, such as human relationships, career, and morality, but not current politics. My answers are posted every week on Mondays, and you can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes on my website. Several years of podcasts are now easily searchable by topic or keywords. If you have a philosophical question to ask me, simply go to www.peikoff.com, and that's spelled P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F, like the word off, peikoff.com. And of course, feel free to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. I've always been attracted to a specific combination of characteristics: self-confidence, innocence, and popularity. Are these true values? I'm not popular myself since I'm an objectivist. So how can I admire that in another person? Good question. Three traits you mentioned. Self-confidence, of course, is an objectivist characteristic. Innocence, well, that depends what you mean. Person without guilt, of course, who could oppose that? But that's a negative, as stated. Or do you mean like naive, childlike, Pollyanna, non-cynical? Well, that depends on the age of the person. If they're, you know, innocent at 17 or 14, that's one thing. If they're 64 they still are naive, that's a question. The fact that you don't want a cynic doesn't mean necessarily you want a quote innocent. But now we get to popularity. Who do you want to be popular with? Presumably, it's non-objectivists, because objectivists, that's what's causing the disaffection of other people. They reject you because of your ideas. Well, if you admire that, you admire them despite that, obviously, ideas are not that important to you. And if they're not, why don't you just drop them? Have your friends, you know, be socialized with objectivists to the extent you agree, but don't call yourself an objectivist and don't make yourself into somebody unpopular, because you'd be, you know, martyring yourself for a cause that you don't really believe in. Now, maybe you want not to be lonely, and that's why you want popularity. But then you have to say, lonely for what? Is it just you can't stay, you know, in four walls with nobody else there? Then you go to Starbucks and read your books with a crowd. Or you want specific people around you socializing and interacting and liking you, because you have to be popular. If that's what you want, loneliness is not the explanation. It seems to me that the only explanation for putting popularity on such a stand as self-confidence is that your self-confidence is down. And so you need the approval from others to help boost it. I think it was Nietzsche who said there were people who run to others in order to flee from themselves. And maybe that's applicable to you. In any case, if you, as you say, you're not popular, but you admire popularity, you got a problem. Why is every person who is anti-Israel also anti-America? Because both stand for the same thing: Western civilization, industrialization, the pursuit of wealth, freedom, success on earth. And this is hated by all fundamentalist religionists and hated by all egalitarian nihilists. Hated by them because they claim all cultures must be equal, and that the way to achieve it is to raise, R-A-Z-E, the West till it's down to the level of the most impoverished and backward. So, of course, both Israel and the United States are mixed. Both are rushing towards self-destruction. But still, compared to the rest of the world, Israel and America and a few European countries and Taiwan will all be hated by the same people. Here's a funnier one. Is it actually true that Ayn Rand detested facial hair on men? If so, did this include hair that was well-groomed? Yes and yes. She regarded a face, certainly as portrayed in fiction or the movie, like a painting, every aspect of which integrated, conveyed the man's, his soul or his way of facing life. So if you put something like a beard or a mustache, to her that was like putting a blotch on a painting. It was hiding the most evocative, expressive essence. It was disfiguring it. Now, of course, if there are physical reasons why you may want these. If you have a bad jawline, you can look better if it's filled out by a beard. My father looked so young for many years that he had to wear a big mustache to convince patients that he was old enough to treat them. But we're talking here about what you would put in a novel and what you would show on the screen. The funny story in this regard is that at one point when Ayn Rand was still involved in making the Atlas Shrugged movie, there was a large conference with all the principals sitting around the table, the producers and her agent and each side's lawyers and I think the representative of the director, et cetera. It was, I don't know, 8 or 10 men and her. She was the only woman. And they were going over the wording of each clause. And they were helping her try to get a wording that would precisely legally prohibit facial hair without getting into the problem of sideburns and how much hair on the top and all the rest of it. So they were trying to word it. And she told me this, so she looked up, looked around the room in the middle of working on this clause, and every single one had a beard or a mustache. So, but they were nevertheless, helping her and trying to figure out a way of wording. So she obviously dealt with those people. She just didn't want them cast in her movie. And, well, I was going to say, if you saw them, you'd know why, but I can't say that, because I think some are still alive. Do you feel any sympathy for any country, especially Western countries, that are not formed out of the Enlightenment or have abandoned the ideas of the Enlightenment, individual rights and so on, and don't know anything about objectivism? No, really I don't, because as you're talking about the West, all of these ideas are easily available in the libraries. The problem is not that Europeans don't know. The intellectuals know, and that would mean the public could know. They don't want it. They reject it. They hate it. They want to get rid of it. I would have sympathy only for anyone in those countries that is trying to grope, I mean, anyone in the non-Western countries is trying to grope for what's better about the United States and comes and studies, and all he can find is, if he could find this, that the ideas of Enlightenment are hidden, denounced, distorted, corrupted, and end up going home knowing nothing or less than he started. I feel sympathy for those people. They think going to Berkeley is the key to success in the West. Little do they know. In The Fountainhead, Rourke wants to create in order to create. Does he care what happens to his work after that? Yes, of course, he cares, but what happens is secondary. That's a consequence of what he does. It's not the essential. It's not the motive that moved him. If he didn't care, then all he would want to do is build the, draw the blueprints. He wouldn't care that much about the building. His whole way of approaching it was, there's a problem, a possibility that he sees, but agony in trying to put it all together. Ayn Rand described a creative process as, I can't remember her exact words, but in The Fountainhead, it's a combination of torture, sexual pleasure, and religious awe. And you have to struggle within that to solve the problem and see the product. Now, while you are creating, you do not think of such questions as, is it going to be taken over by TUI, or is it going to become a home for subnormal children, or is it whatever? If you think the project is something you want to exercise your faculty on, you're not living in a dictatorship, so you know there's a possibility, you don't even think of that. You think of solving the problem and what the work requires. And now, without boasting, I have to say that that is exactly the way I have always worked. Now, for instance, you take OPAR, that was my life mission from the time I met her, to organize her philosophy step by step and present it in a book. That is, of course, I was glad that people buy it and people thank me and it helps them and so on. But quite honestly, it never entered my mind when I was writing it. The only thing in my mind was, I don't understand this point. I've got to get it once and for all. Oh, now I see this connection to this, but what about that? Only that. And then after it was over, I'm still not convinced how many people are helped by it. I mean, I'm glad if they are. But that was not the creative motivation. Maybe if I was aiming for a bestseller, I would be more concerned. But in the kind of creative work we're talking about, that's not applicable. I saw OPAR and the fact that any book I did is like a cosmic crossword puzzle. And my goal was to try to solve it. And then if somebody wanted to frame it or pay for it or whatever, that was a separate issue. In her early writing years, how did Ayn Rand manage having a job that was unrelated to her career to support herself while still pursuing her writing? Did she ever mention any suggestions as to the best way for a person to deal with such a situation? Well, I don't remember her ever discussing it with me, but some things I know that are relevant. One, she worked very long hours to keep the job and to work on her first novel, We the Living. She worked an 8-hour job, then had a long public transportation, and then worked, I think, 4 or 5 nights a week and all weekends writing. So it was a killing load, but she had to. That's the only way she could do it. Another thing I know, she was not bitter about it. She understood why this would have to be. She was a beginner. She hadn't proved to any publisher that they should give her an advance. She's starting from the beginning, and therefore she has to accept reality. So she didn't have the burden of anger and rage that this was the kind of society she was in. And I think also very important, and this she did tell me, she expressed her emotions in this regard openly to herself and to her husband. Really, she expressed her hatred of the jobs that she had to take. For instance, she was a waitress at one point. She was selling newspapers, subscriptions. She was organizing wardrobe and the RKO pictures, etc. She hated those jobs. Not the fact that she needed a job, but the actual hour-by-hour nonsense that she had to do. And this may surprise you. When she got home and sat down to write, or after writing one evening, she cried. Not every day, but often, she said that. She cried openly and guiltlessly at home because it was so real to her how valuable what she was doing was and how much it was stopped and delayed by factors outside of her control. And I think that's one of the things that got her through it, because she didn't repress it. She didn't push it aside and say, well, I can't do it full time, so I'll just let it sit there. You cut down your own feeling for your own work, your own value. She kept it alive in her mind full time that was what she was valuing, because in the face of that frustration, in private, she let out in the form of crying what she actually felt. That surprises people. Because she certainly didn't cry in public. But it's very understandable if you understand her psychology. If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peikoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most famous novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Thanks for listening.